Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 218, and of course, it's a continuation of what we began in episode 217, the story of James Meredith and the Oxford Riots. As I explained to you in the prologue of episode 217, this is more about the war that occurred than it is about the actual admission of James Meredith to the university. It's a deep dive into the violence that occurred and the level of engagement by the federal authorities to ensure that Meredith would be accepted. Few people understand the level of force that was necessary to make this occur. Some of you may come away with the idea that this was just too much to present. Others of you will accept the fact that there was much more to this than most of us at first glance would understand or acknowledge. And this is a rather crude way to get the point across, perhaps, because I tell this story in excruciating detail. And it's a military history, because that is exactly what it was. It was an act of domestic terror. It was an act of war. It was an act that was met with courage, and it was an act that would define the level of hatred and violence that the Kennedys would face in the months to come. President Kennedy was assassinated less than 14 months after the events occurred in Oxford. These were fresh moments of hatred, and they had already reached a high altitude. Sadly, they had not reached their own height. Not yet. So, without further ado, let's listen to the rest of episode 218 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. While the Army prepared, a complicated political drama played out between the President and his advisors in Washington and the administration of Governor Barnett in Jackson, Mississippi. Department of Justice officials attempted unsuccessfully to enroll Meredith at least four times. The telephone wires between Washington and Jackson burned with a series of frustrating conversations between Robert Kennedy, Burke Marshall, and even the President on one side, and Barnett and the Mississippi Attorney General, and at least two intermediaries on the other. Among the approaches discussed in Robert Kennedy's office were proposals that President Kennedy invite Barnett to the White House, much as President Eisenhower had invited Governor Faubus to Newport. That Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, a Southerner, escort Meredith to the Oxford campus for enrollment. Or that official sources feed Barnett a false report that a division of regular troops had been alerted for duty in Mississippi in hopes of bringing him into compliance. Sending troops in is a hell of a thing for the country, Robert Kennedy remarked. In this spirit, he briefly agreed to an absurd plan suggested by the governor, in which Barnett would stand aside and personally admit Meredith to the campus on September 27th, if an escort of about 30 marshals would draw their revolvers, enabling the governor to claim that he had given way due only to overwhelming odds. In the end, however, the president opted for a suggestion by historian Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. The attorney general would make a public statement urging compliance with court orders and quoting the Mississippi legislature's rejection in 1832 of John C. Calhoun's doctrine of nullification as an unconstitutional, and I quote, heresy, fatal to the existence of the Union. From one point of view, the efforts of the Kennedy administration to avoid the use of force had established a record of forbearance and patience. But not everyone agreed with this charitable view. The head of the Legal Defense Fund for the NAACP, Jack Greenberg, saw the administration's efforts to achieve integration of the university by jawboning or compromise as merely foolish. Mississippi officials would fail to keep their part of any agreement they made, he observed. On that account, the federal government would have done better to make a real show of force at the beginning. For Meredith himself, living through a time of immense anxiety, the prospect of some sort of bargain between the government and Barnett became the source of, and I quote, the greatest uncertainty. As the tension increased, Mississippi officials continued to ignore the orders of the federal court. Meanwhile, the ongoing effort to find a compromise or a satisfactory formula for compliance had very little influence on the actions of Barnett. The governor personally barred Meredith's enrollment at the university on September 20th, and again 5 days later, when the student presented himself at the Jackson offices of the university's Board of Trustees. The next day, Lieutenant Governor Paul B. Johnson, with a considerable body of Mississippi law enforcement officers, barred Meredith's way at the Oxford campus. On the 27th, Meredith and his escort of marshals themselves turned back on orders from Robert Kennedy, who had become concerned about the menace that filled the air at Oxford. Within an hour after this setback, Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach asked the Army to move the engineer task force assigned to build the tent city from Fort Campbell to Memphis and to remain there until further notice. Abrams passed the word to Conark. When the officers involved wanted to know what the commander of the convoy should do if Mississippi officials blocked his way, the only response they received was the not very helpful guidance that he should avoid using force. Despite forebodings, the first step proved easy. The main body of engineers arrived without incident at Memphis Naval Air Station at about 5 o'clock in the morning on September 28th. It consisted of the 70th Engineer Battalion with attached medical, signal, quartermaster, and information detachments from the 101st Airborne Division. The force comprised of 7 officers and 105 enlisted men under the command of Major Ralph S. Christofferson. At the air station, Christofferson learned that Abrams had assumed operational control of his little command for the Department of the Army, but that he would continue to receive logistical and administrative support from the Third Army in the Continental Army Command, or CONARC. He also received instructions that under the Pose Comitatus Act, he could move only upon the order of the Department of the Army and not upon that of the federal marshals. Rumors about the number of troops in the area and their activities received wide coverage in the press, leaving the engineers at a loss because the public affairs plan for the operation provided no guidance on what they could tell reporters. Katzenbach issued instructions through the senior Department of Justice official at the scene at the time. His name was Marshal John W. Cameron, and he told them that they should have no release of information about the activities of federal marshals or troops at the air station. Since this counsel hardly seemed helpful under the circumstances, they sought further guidance from Washington through the Third Army, but again received no response. From that point on, little authoritative information was available because the Naval Air Station was closed to newsmen and the public. Instead, an enterprising reporter telephoned Fort Campbell's deputy commander, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas A. Price. He learned that the engineers were armed because they had been dispatched under a, and I quote, test exercise procedure, that there were no orders to send this force anywhere else, and that the air station could accommodate several hundred marshals. Since no marshals might tax facilities at the air station, Price explained, the engineers had been called in. They had stoves and blankets in case anyone had to sleep in tents. The cover story fooled no one. Press dispatches observed correctly that Christofferson's force was the first detachment of federal troops to be ordered to any kind of duties in connection with the attempt to enroll Mr. Meredith. As the crisis continued, the force of federal marshals and deputy marshals at Memphis rapidly expanded from 140 on Thursday evening, September 27th, to over 500 by Saturday evening. Making up the forces, commanded by Chief U.S. Marshal James J.P. McShane, were regular marshals, some from as far away as California. The group included border patrolmen, including so many from Texas that the Mexican border stood virtually unguarded, and federal prison guards from Atlanta, Georgia, Leavenworth, Kansas, and Terre Haute, Indiana were also there. Although they came from all parts of the nation, well over half the men hailed from the South, as did Alabama-born Assistant Attorney General Louis F. Oberdorfer, the ranking Department of Justice official on hand. All concerned, even the marshals were sworn in as special deputy marshals and organized into groups. With the marshals ready, Christofferson and his task force left Memphis Naval Air Station and arrived at about 7:30 in the morning on Sunday, September 30th. Now at their final destination, an isolated campsite 17 miles from Oxford in Holly Springs National Forest. The information released on the deployment was sparse. Although the Department of Justice granted some interviews, it denied reporters and photographers access to the bivouac area, all but assuring that the deployment would receive maximum press coverage. During the day that followed, a curious crowd of local citizens assembled at the site, along with the local sheriff, members of the state police, and some 70 newsmen. General Abrams reached the staging area at the Naval Air Station at midday on Sunday. He reported that night that the tent city was in good shape, adequate, with lights, latrines, showers, and mess. Overall, it was okay. The engineers were also working on sending 200 cots and floodlights to the federal marshals in Oxford. Meanwhile, the tactical units were being readied as well. When the Army launched active preparations for possible military involvement in Mississippi, planners had visualized a task force composed of one battle group in a military police battalion. But as planning proceeded, they opted instead for two task forces drawn from units designated for the Army Strike Command. Task Force Alpha, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel John J. Flanagan, was to be a composite force of 689 officers and enlisted men drawn mainly from the 503rd Military Police Battalion at Fort Bragg. Task Force Bravo was headed by Major General Charles H. Chase, the commander of the 2nd Infantry Division. This group was more varied. With over 1,000 soldiers, its main components were the 2nd Battle Group from the 23rd Infantry at Fort Benning, commanded by Colonel Lucien F. Keller, and Company B, 2nd Battle Group 9th Infantry, both from Chase's division. Also included were various support units from other organizations. The Tactical Air Command would support both task forces. On September 26, the day state authorities turned Meredith away from the university for the third time, General Abrams outlined the existing plan to military and Justice Department officials at a conference at Secretary Vance's home. The Justice Department expected that its fourth attempt the next day to enter Meredith into the university would, again, meet with resistance, and that the marshals would once more have to withdraw. As events unfolded, the Army had to consider the likelihood that it would shortly have to commit troops, not only at Oxford, but also at the state capitol at Jackson, should it have to support the arrest of Governor Barnett. In that case, a decision would have to be made after the 28th, when Barnett was supposed to be in New Orleans to show cause as to why he should not be cited for contempt. The conferees recognized the possibility that he might not appear and that a warrant for his arrest might be issued. Although uncertainty over Barnett's movements left military planning open, the impending operation took clearer form in other respects. The conferees agreed to call out the National Guard, only when and if required. A decision that put regular Army troops into the forefront of any intervention that developed. There was further agreement that the lines of command would run directly from Washington to Brigadier General Charles Billingsley, who on the day of the meeting had succeeded Major General Charles H. Chase as commander of the 2nd Infantry Division and thus of the tactical forces at Oxford. The same channel would also be used for all major guidance and directions from Washington, where the necessary coordination would occur between the Departments of Justice and Defense and the Army. As for the troops, they were to make no advance moves, but were to be prepared to proceed to Oxford or Jackson or places simultaneously, depending upon the situation and the actions of the governor. With those plans in place, events began to move rapidly toward their climax. On September 27th, an attempt to move Meredith to the university failed. Another attempt, employing between 300 and 400 marshals, was slated for the next day. According to the plan, if that final civilian effort also failed, the Army would force access by moving a major portion of Task Force Alpha to the scene by air. On the 28th, with the final effort to move Meredith onto campus in the offing, CONARC issued a comprehensive operations plan setting forth explicitly for the first time the actual mission of its two task forces and their areas of operations. Provision was also made to move portions of Task Force Bravo by surface and air to reinforce Alpha if necessary. On the same day, General Abrams briefed the Chief of Staff designate, General Wheeler, and the Vice Chief of Staff on the latest plans. At the meeting, the Vice Chief suggested that a general officer remain on duty in the Army War Room 24 hours a day for as long as the troops were in action. Wheeler, doubtless reflecting his experience as General Taylor's personal representative in Little Rock, also had advice, which Abrams summarized in a subsequent memorandum as follows. The plan laid out for the troops should be in detail and well organized, and the troops well instructed in it so that when they arrived, they would go about the performance of their mission without lost motion in a very businesslike and knowledgeable and firm fashion. He felt it was appropriate to have ammunition on the person, but only if it were permitted to be loaded in weapons. The troops must have a very high sense of discipline, be especially responsive to orders and requirements of high disciplinary standards. Troops should be well informed, particularly in holding their tempers, not engaging in arguments with civilians. They should be prepared to accept abusive language calmly and resolutely, and soldiers losing control of their emotions should be immediately removed from the scene of the operation. Although the 28th brought a reprieve in the form of a court order giving the governor until the following Tuesday to admit Meredith to the university before being considered in contempt of court and becoming subject to arrest, the deadline led the Army to form a third task force shortly after midnight on the morning of the 29th of September. Task Force Charlie, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Bryce Emmett, would be composed of the 716th Military Police Battalion, stationed at Fort Dix, New Jersey, together with the 5th and the 17th Field Hospitals, a public information section, and a composite intelligence detachment, 617 men in all. In the meantime, Army headquarters sent Billingsley the texts of two proposed messages. The first designated him the field commander and provided him with basic instructions. The second, a so-called fragmentary order, set out assumed Army missions resulting from expected executive orders. The second draft document provided a scenario of possible events. According to it, Army planners expected Mississippi officials to prevent the enrollment of Meredith at the university. The governor and key members of his administration would then take refuge from the U.S. Court of Appeals, and they would do so on the 10th floor of the bank building in Jackson, ringed and occupied by Mississippi State Police and deputies. To enforce federal court orders, the Army would have to remove any persons obstructing the governor's arrest and Meredith's enrollment and attendance at the university. Afterward, it would have to maintain law and order. The draft alerted Billingsley to the possible use of the National Guard, the necessity for formulating plans both to phase Guard units into the operation and eventually to remove regular Army units from the Oxford area. While the Army would, and I quote, use minimum strength and force to accomplish its mission, necessity might require it to employ the entire task force. By then, codenamed Oxford. If a squad were sufficient, Billingsley was to avoid using a platoon, but to ensure successful completion of the mission, his reserve forces were to be responsive to any escalation requiring more troops. The same policy was to govern the use of weapons. The troops would begin with unloaded rifles and no bayonets and progress as necessity required to unloaded rifles carrying fixed but sheathed bayonets, then tear gas, then unloaded rifles with fixed bayonets unsheathed, and finally, loaded rifles. There were to be similar priorities for carbines and pistols, but strict adherence to weapons policy was never to jeopardize successful completion of the mission. Since the Army's mission involved only the removal of obstructions to justice, federal marshals were to take civilian troublemakers into custody whenever possible. If Army personnel were obliged to hold civilians, they were to turn their prisoners over to a marshal as quickly as possible. They were not to escort Meredith or to apprehend or escort Barnett or any other Mississippi official. They were only to provide, and I quote, the assurance that no one would interfere with a marshal's duties. With the Army integrated and about 15% of the personnel selected for the Mississippi operation black, whether blacks should participate in the operation posed a special problem. The question had arisen at Little Rock. Operational commanders had settled it at that time by separating the black soldiers of the 101st Airborne Division from white civilians. This was the approach initially selected for Oxford, but as time shortened, General Abrams had second thoughts. On September 27th, he informed Attorney General Kennedy that to avoid promoting any sort of incident, he would allow his black troops to proceed to the objective area, but had instructed commanders verbally to refrain from committing them to action. General Wheeler later adopted the policy and stated it explicitly in personally written instructions to Billingsley's successor. And I quote, keep Negro troops in base camps or administrative support duties. Through some failure in communication, however, black members of the Task Force Alpha and Bravo were thereafter clearly in evidence in Oxford. Meanwhile, the commanders of the units composing Task Force Charlie apparently also misinterpreted the instruction, but in the opposite direction, leaving most of their black members at home. On Saturday, September 29th, receiving orders to move Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, the Army authorized placing a new task force, Delta, on alert at Fort Benning. Formed around the 2nd Battle Group, 1st Infantry Delta included a company of the 2nd Battle Group, 9th Infantry, together with necessary support troops, 1,196 additional men altogether. Its commander was Colonel Edgar R. Poole. That same evening, the pace of events began to accelerate. The Tactical Air Command ordered execution of its operational plans to provide airlift for Task Forces Alpha and Charlie. And about 2,200 men, with the Air Force waiting, orders to the 1st and 3rd U.S. Armies required them to execute their operational instructions. Alpha and Charlie were to move to the Memphis staging area by air, while Bravo was to join them by surface transportation, avoiding Mississippi en route. Within the hour, Major Christofferson received final notification to take the 10th City force to Mississippi. And word reached Abrams that the president wanted a force of 500 military policemen at the Memphis staging area, in addition to those already scheduled for arrival there. This resulted in orders on the 720th Military Police Battalion at Fort Hood, which now became Task Force Echo. Within the same hour, the Attorney General left for the White House, and Secretary Vance took up station in the Pentagon. General Wheeler was brought up to date, and at 5 minutes before midnight, the Army leadership learned that a presidential press conference or briefing would be held 35 minutes later at 12:30 a.m. Sunday morning. Procedures and the legal citations followed well-established precedents. At 1 minute past midnight on September 30th, 1962, President Kennedy signed a proclamation declaring that the governor of Mississippi and other officers and persons in that state were willfully opposing and obstructing the enforcement of federal court orders. In consequence, enforcement of federal laws in Mississippi by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings was impractical. The governor had failed to give adequate assurances that federal court orders would be obeyed and that the law and order would be maintained. Therefore, the president commanded, and I quote, "all persons engaged in such obstructions of justice to cease and desist therefrom, and to disperse and retire peaceably forthwith," citing as his authority the Constitution and laws of the United States, including Chapter 15 of Title 10 of the United States Code, particularly Sections 332, 333, and 334. Army headquarters in Washington had expected a time lag between the proclamation and the executive order, as had happened in the case of Little Rock, but Kennedy issued his proclamation and executive order more or less simultaneously. His executive order quoted the essential parts of the proclamation and declared that, since the proclamation's commands had not been obeyed, obstruction of the court orders still existed and threatened to continue. Again, citing the legal authority set forth in the proclamation together with Section 301 of Title 3 of the U.S. Code, he authorized the Secretary of Defense to take steps to enforce the relevant federal court orders and to remove obstructions to justice in Mississippi. Thank you for listening to Episode 218 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. And join us in episode 219 as we continue the story of James Meredith and the Oxford Riots.